Hello there, sex fans. Welcome back. Today is Wednesday, December 1st, 2010, and you are lucky enough to be listening to the podcast edition of Dr. Dick's Sex Advice with an Edge. With your host, that savagely scintillating sexologist, Dr. Dick. That's me.
Oh, you are the best person in the whole world.
You'll get no argument from me. Damn, I got some mighty fine stuff to share with you today. This being the Sex Wisdom series, you've come to expect prominent movers and shakers in the field of human sexuality as my guests. And that's because, over the last year, we've chatted with researchers, educators, clinicians, pundits, and philosophers, each one making news and reshaping how we look at our sexual selves. Y'all probably know of my special interest in sexuality and spirituality, right? I mean, for me, there is no more potent place in the human psyche than where eroticism and religion come together. So when I had an opportunity to visit with Brad Warner, Zen monk, prolific author, punk rocker, and filmmaker, I jumped on it.
So true, so wise.
Why are you being so nice to me today? You know, Brad is my kind of monk. He's got his finger on the pulse of the popular culture. He can raise hell with the best of them and still remain centered as a Zen master. No small task that, my friends. He and I will be talking about loads of very interesting stuff, including his latest book, Sex, Sin, and Zen, a Buddhist exploration of sex from celibacy to polyamory and everything in between. This is not to be missed, people. For more of Brad and his marvelous and insightful writing, visit him on his website, hardcorezen.blogspot.com. Today's program is once again brought to you by Dr. Dick's How-To Video Library. You know, even though I get tons of email from folks looking for my advice, I can only respond to a limited number of inquiries at any given time. But that doesn't mean that I don't care about everyone who writes in. I do. That's why I've set up the How-To Video Library. You'll find a link to this great resource right there on the front page of drdicksexadvice.com. Look for the Dr. Dick's How-To Video Library banner in the sidebar.
I want to help you. What can I do?
Hey, wait, that's my line. The video library is the go-to place for all of you who have sexual performance questions. You'll be able to watch all kinds of deliciously entertaining, delightfully enriching, and oh-so-informative videos right from the comfort of your own home. How sweet is that? Okay, on with the show. Welcome, Brad Warner, and thank you for dropping by DrDickSexAdvice.com. I am so delighted that you are finally able to join me for this Sex Wisdom podcast. And now that you're here, would you like to say hello to all the nice people?
Well, hello, nice people. How are you?
There's probably some funky people out there, too. So.
Yeah, well, they can't answer me anyway.
Exactly that.
Even though I asked how they are. But.
Well, I'll tell you I'm fine, so...
Good.
Good, good, good. So, you know, I've been looking forward to our visit for a very long time. Your publicist, the charming Kib Coburn, sent me a copy of your newest book, Sex, Sin, and Zen, a Buddhist exploration of sex from celibacy to polyamory and everything in between, way back in August. And I've been salivating for this event ever since. Sadly, our schedules and other inconsequential human endeavors prevented us from making this happen until now. What's up with that?
Well, sorry about that. I got deeply involved in this book I've been writing. And
oh,
then
really?
Kind of
how cool.
Me up.
What's the new book?
Well, so far it's called The Zen of Godzilla, but it's too early to say whether that's going to actually be the finished product.
I see. Okay. So surely there is a Zen saying or an attitude that can be applied to situations like the one we've been in when our best intentions are frustrated by the trivialities of life. Is there?
Boy, I can't think of a specific saying, but, you know, it's just, that's just the way things always go. It's always, in the Zen practice, what you're always doing is trying to look at the gap between how things really are and how you want them to be, and as much as possible, ignore how you want them to be. You know, you have, everybody has a sense of how they want things to be. But, you know, if you're mature at all, you realize that it's never going to be exactly the way you want it. But we get really frustrated with that gap.
Oh, gosh. Me in particular. Yeah. I don't know. I try as I might, you know. And I think I'm much better now, much later in my life than I was as a young man. But still, I'm flummoxed often by the fates, for lack of a better word. So the reason I've been so impatient for our encounter, I mean, besides the fact that you are a remarkable fellow with a fascinating life story, is that I'm almost never get to talk about religion and sex with somebody who knows something about both. So if I talk your ear off, just tell me to sit down and shut up, which also happens to be one of the titles of one of your other books. But more about that later. So allow me to get right to the heart of it. Why do you suppose Westerners have such a difficult time putting the two concepts, sexuality and spirituality, together?
Well, it's basically because our Western religions have this body-mind or spirit-matter dichotomy that, and actually this is true of most Eastern religions as well. So they separate mind and matter, you know, or and call mind spirit or soul or something.
Right.
And then they say that matter is base and impure and it's what we're trying to transcend, and the spirit is lofty and that's what we're trying to go for. So sex is something to be avoided in that kind of a philosophical outlook. Buddhism takes the outlook that body and mind are both more or less equal manifestations of something that isn't body and isn't mind. It's something that kind of includes both, but at the same time, it's more than both.
Mm-hmm.
So there isn't, you know, it's going too far to say that there isn't a problem with sex in Buddhism, because there's a lot of things. People are kind of surprised, and I don't know why, that there are just as many Buddhisms out there as there are Christianities or Judaisms out there.
Mm-hmm.
But at least as far as the Zen Buddhism is concerned in general, again, there isn't quite so much of a big deal about sex.
Mm-hmm. And that's basically because it's part of the world, and we, you know, just need to deal with it, or, you know.
Yeah. In general, I mean, it's because there isn't this idea that the body is base and impure and to be transcended. Now, in the original Buddhist order that Buddha himself founded, there was an idea that monks should practice celibacy, very strict celibacy.
Right.
And but that was only ever applied to monks, and that was more about keeping the monastic tradition focused on meditation.
Right.
And generally speaking, even in those Buddhist sects I should go back a little bit. In Japanese Buddhism, in the 1800s, they did away with the vow of celibacy, even for monks.
Wow.
So there is no longer a vow of celibacy, which is probably one of the reasons I was able to become a monk. Because I don't think I would have done it otherwise. But even in Japan, it's basically, I think in the Japanese style is more true to the original roots. I mean, I would say that because I'm an adherent of it, but the idea was always that you became a monk for a certain amount of time. You did what I mean is you become a monk for life, but you do the monastic thing for a certain amount of time, and then you're done with it.
Yes.
So a monk in the Catholic tradition means you become a monk and you go into a monastery, and if you should move out of the monastery, then you are no longer a monk.
Mm-hmm.
In the Buddhist tradition, that's not the case. You're actually encouraged out of the monastery. You're not supposed to live there for your whole life.
Right.
So that's what happens. So even in the Japanese tradition, it's generally understood that monks, when they're in monastic training, should be celibate, or if they're married, they're married. Mm-hmm. But generally, you're not seeing your spouse if you're in monastic training. So you're, you know, if you're true to your marriage, you're celibate anyway.
So
for at least
so you're not making a distinction necessarily between celibacy and sexual abstinence. Celibacy, at least from my point of view, the dictionary definition is a renunciation of marriage, you know, not being married. And in my tradition, the Catholic tradition, and of which I was a priest for, you know, 20 plus years, scary. I'm going to tell you all about it in a minute. But the point is that, you know, it was a renunciation of marriage, and in the Catholic tradition, there was no sexual expression outside the confines of marriage. So that was a double bind. So you couldn't be sexually active as a Catholic priest because you were celibate. Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, kind of a disturbing sort of thing, because, you know, there didn't account much for gay Catholic priests, for example.
Yeah.
So, anyhow, it's a very interesting kind of thing. So, and many people don't make that distinction, even in the popular culture, and they say, you know, I'm being celibate. Well, you can be celibate in a marriage, yes, or just abstinent in a marriage. That's a question.
I always thought that abstinence and celibacy were synonyms. So I didn't realize that there was a different dictionary definition. And I suppose it makes sense, though, because in Buddhism there isn't this idea of no sex before marriage. It doesn't really come up. Mm-hmm. Even in Buddha's advice to lay people as far as sex was concerned, he doesn't mention that. He says you shouldn't have sex with somebody who's already married or betrothed to someone else, but he doesn't say anything about not having sex with someone you're not married to. Mm-hmm. So my guess is that in India there wasn't really this idea of no sex before marriage really didn't exist. But I don't know. So I suppose when you are talking about the ancient Buddhist vow of celibacy, it was a vow of sexual abstinence, and
that was pertinent only to the time that an individual was in a monastic situation.
Yeah, generally speaking, right. I think in the earliest days you were monastic for life in Indian Buddhism. Although that's you know, going back a long time, so I'm not really familiar with that. And there are traditions in Asia where you become a monastic for life. That's not the Japanese tradition, and I don't think it's the Chinese tradition either. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly not the American tradition in Buddhism.
Right. And one of the things that you make a point of saying over and over again is that that religion, Buddhism in particular, from your perspective, is caught in history. I mean, what the founders of a particular religion had in mind, you know, at their time, may not necessarily be totally applicable to the lives of the adherents of that religion, you know, 20 centuries later.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. And generally speaking, when you're talking about a religion, you're talking about something that has a code of ethics or morality or behavior, whatever it is, mm-hmm. that goes back, you know, a couple thousand years. And generally speaking, our idea of a religion is that we are trying to live as much as possible according to this this code of ethics, which we are told is timeless and unchangeable. So we can't change, you know, what is it, a jot or a tittle is what I think the Bible says, right?
Yes, exactly.
Which is always a fun thing to say. But in Buddhism, they don't have this idea. The Buddha himself, I'm hard-pressed to think of the actual quotes, but he makes some statements which to me always implied that he understood that that Buddhism was going to change mm-hmm. after he died, mm-hmm. and that we shouldn't... Well, he does say this about the precepts. He says they're developed these long, long list of precepts that Buddhist monks were supposed to adhere to, and just before he died, Buddha said, it's important to keep the major precepts, but don't worry too much about the minor ones. And then he didn't he did never explain which were major and minor, meaning that he was leaving it up to generations after him to figure out which were major and which were minor. And there have been significant revisions, and Buddhism is kind of open to revisions like that.
I think that's fascinating. And from what I can gather, and I hasten to add that I am no expert, Buddhism is based on five precepts of right conduct, one of them being to abstain from sexual misconduct, or to put it another way, not to go the wrong way for sexual pleasure. Zen Buddhists deal with sexuality within a broader category of sensual indulgence. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, that's kind of the way it's usually given. In the Zen tradition, we generally keep 10 precepts, but that's, you know, whether there's 5 or whether there's 10 is kind of a matter of, you know, which sect you're talking about. And the first 5 are really the big ones. Mm-hmm. And number 3 of those 5 is usually given as do not misuse sexuality. Although my teacher, the person I took the precepts from, changed that, and he gives that precept as don't desire too much.
Yes.
So he eliminates the idea of sex from the precept right there and gives it a much broader meaning,
right,
which I think is interesting.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's sensual indulgence. I mean, it's an idea that you shouldn't, well, desire too much. You don't indulge too much. It's not that you have to give up all desire. That's one of the kind of common misunderstandings of Buddhism that's out there, and it's in a lot of the books that you still can find about Buddhism, which says, you know, you should give up all desire. And there isn't that. It's more about coming to terms with the desires you have, mm-hmm, and seeing which ones, some of your desires are worth fulfilling, you know, the desire to drink water, the desire to eat, you know, the desire to breathe. These are, you can't eliminate that.
Right.
And you can't eliminate desire altogether. Nobody's been able to do that. So it's a matter of seeing what your desires actually are, where they come from, and whether they're worth fulfilling or whether it's better. You know, a lot of times you have a desire and it's best to just let it pass.
Exactly that. So you've come to study Zen when you were 18, right?
Yeah, about. It's hard for me to remember. I always write this when I write the story of how I started. It was either my first or second year of university, and unfortunately my transcripts are not clear on when. Because the class I took, I took a class called Zen Buddhism, and bizarrely enough, Kent State University did not give you college credit for a course in Zen Buddhism. So it's not on my transcripts. Anyway, so I was 18 or 19.
Right. Yeah. Were you born and raised in a Western religious tradition?
No, not at all. I
no
was.
Kidding.
We were sort of vaguely Protestant. What I mean is, the family just didn't have a religion. My parents never went to church, as far as I knew, and my grandparents never went to church.
No kidding.
We weren't a religious. It wasn't like we were this, you know, radical family of atheists or anything like that. It just, nobody seemed to really care, and that was the, you know, that was the atmosphere I grew up in. Nobody really cared much about religion.
Mm-hmm. So maybe this would be a good place for you to tell us a bit about your personal, spiritual, and sexual journey. And be sure to include your background in punk rock, because I think that's fascinating.
Well, yeah, I discovered Buddhism because I'd been into the punk rock scene. I was really deep into the hardcore punk scene in Ohio in the early 80s, and I was I was a bass player for this band called Zero Defects that did our big hit song was Drop the A-Bomb on Me, which is 18 seconds long, and can be found on iTunes now, I just found out.
No kidding.
So I was into that, and the reason I got into punk rock was because I was very concerned about what was true. I became aware in my teenage years that that there was a hereditary disease in my family called Huntington's disease, which is a bit like Parkinson's, and but not quite as popular. And two of my aunts were already in the advanced stages of it, and my mom was starting to show things that, that they were worried were symptoms, and it turned out they were symptoms, but, you know, at the time we didn't know. So this was weighing heavy on my mind, because people who have that illness usually don't, you know, they around their mid-30s, they start degenerating, and you know, they don't live very long. So I felt it was really urgent to figure out what the truth was, what life was all about. And most of the religions, you know, I immediately went to Protestant churches, but and I've learned that there's a lot more to Christianity than the Christianity I was exposed to. But I think it's relevant. The Christianity I was exposed to was very much it was about life after death. And nothing more, really, as far as I could tell. They were doing all of this stuff in order to ensure that their life after death would be good. And I didn't know if I believed in life after death. But I could believe in the life I was living now. I believe that's real. And so what I was interested in is finding out what this life I'm living now is. And Buddhism impressed me, Zen Buddhism in particular impressed me, because it wasn't about the afterlife. It was, Buddhism, Zen is very interesting, because people think Buddhism is all about reincarnation. Well, that's, Tibetan Buddhism tends to be a lot about reincarnation. But in Zen, we don't even talk about reincarnation. It's like, you know, maybe there's reincarnation, maybe there's not, but we're not concerned about that. What we're concerned about is this life. And how to make this life work. So I just was deeply impressed when I discovered this, and also because I felt it had a lot of the same attitude that I'd found in punk rock, which was the attitude of just, let's not worry about what about speculating, you know, around things we can't know. Let's deal with what we do know now and make the best of that. And that was important to me. If you do this meditation process, the Zazen process, long enough, you start to notice things which were not hidden, really, but which you had not noticed.
Do you have to quiet yourself in order to see, like, movement, for example? If you're going to, you know, sit in nature to see nature in its glory, you have to sit quietly, right?
Yeah, and that's the idea. You sit very, very quietly and very still for a long period of time and allow what you actually are to manifest without interfering with it. Yeah. So you're not trying to stop your thoughts or stop your mind or
even make judgments about them as they appear, like this is a bad thought or this is a good thought. And
that's right. You don't judge them at all, which is really difficult to do, because that's it's something we do all the time, and it's something that really in general is not something you want to not do. You know, you want to be able to judge whether your thoughts are I don't know, good or bad is a very broad term. You want to be able to judge whether your thoughts are things you should be acting upon or not acting upon, and that's important. But then we move away from that and start saying this one is good and this one is bad and this one is me and this one is not me, and that's where we kind of go wrong. After doing the Zazen process for a while, you start to realize that there's a lot of thoughts that don't fit into what your perception of your idealized self is, and you learn to let those go as well.
How interesting. You know, I've been spending a great deal of time on your website, hardcorezen.blogspot.com. I love your writing.
Thank you.
Good. Recently, you were commenting about the notion of sexual preferences, and you write, "One of the many interesting aspects of Zen practice for me personally has been the discovery that there is a tremendous amount of variety in the thoughts and desires that arise in my mind once I stop working so hard at defining myself to myself. among the many things I discovered was the fact that my own personal sexual orientation was not fixed and rigid. Since I'm the kind of person I am, the idea that I could occasionally find men sexually appealing was not really a big shock. Some of the other stuff I recognized about myself was truly disturbing. That I could be attracted to men was no big deal, especially by comparison. That's so insightful, it seems to me.
I guess I've come out of the closet or something. Just so any men in the audience listening don't get the wrong idea, my feeling is that these things bubble up through my cranium, but they're kind of on the level of things that I don't really have any great desire to act upon. They
right.
just come up.
Right.
But that has been interesting, and that's, you know, I'm trying to give that as an example of the kinds of things that come up, because there's all sorts of categories. And if you talk about the category of sex, you know, one of the things that comes up is you find out you have all kinds of weird desires, or desires that you previously thought of as weird.
Yes, and that's the point, it seems to me, is that you know, humankind, I mean, if we allow ourselves to go relatively unfiltered for even a short period of time, we know that, you know, that there is this flow of you know, sexual energy through ourselves, you know, that, you know, come from all kinds of different places. I mean, watching animals have sex, you know.
I read about that.
Exactly. So it's a fascinating kind of thing. I mean, our bodies are responding to stimuli that, you know, are, you know, pre-conscious, at least, you know. I mean,
oh, yeah.
So it's a fascinating thing. And the thing that I took away from that, that paragraph that you wrote, was that the idea that we must pigeonhole ourselves into a fixed identity, and in doing so cut ourselves off from the influences around us, seems particularly counterproductive. This is true in terms of sexuality as well as spiritual practices. Would you not agree?
It's one of the things we do. We have a personality, and we need to have a personality in order to interact with the world. And we need to have, you know, our likes and our dislikes and our personal preferences and all of that. That's necessary. But we kind of latch upon that and call it self, and then we think that this self, I mean, we once we have establish the idea of self, we establish a whole lot of other ideas about what self can do, you know, that self is eternally separate from everything else, and that it might last forever, or it might die, or it might get hurt, or, you know, all these other things. And what we're doing is we are first creating something that doesn't exist in the first place, and then becoming very, very, very concerned about this thing that never really existed in the first place. And it's one of the hard things when people get into Buddhism to understand, is this idea of no self or non-self. They think we have to give up something that really exists, but it's not like that. It's more a matter of coming to terms with the fact that this is just a fantasy, and it was always just a fantasy, and if you give it up, nothing really changes. Mm-hmm. You don't lose your personality just because you stop believing that it's a fixed thing. You still have it. Mm-hmm. That's what I noticed. You know, it was one of the first clues I had when I first started Zen Buddhist practice, was noticing that my teachers were not like robots or unfeeling. They weren't the caricature of the Zen Buddhist that you see on TV. They were people with real personalities, very strong personalities. And so I was no longer, you know, seeing that. A lot of people get into this practice and then they get scared. They're like, oh my God, I'm going to lose my personality. Well, there's no danger of that. There really isn't.
Well, you know, I see the same kind of thing, you know, as people get deeper and deeper into Christianity. I mean, they feel like they have to jettison something that is very unique about themselves in order to embrace, you know, the dogma. And, you know, that just seems really unfortunate, it seems, because I don't think that that's what, you know, Christianity is all about. But there you go. So you also make the point that some Christian leaders have preconceived ideas about the practice of yoga, for example, and which is an expansion of the comment I just made about the influence or influences around us. If we close ourselves off, they become counterproductive. And a lot of fundamentalist Christian leaders tell their flocks that yoga is a bad thing.
Yeah, it's going to open them up to Satan.
Don't you just love it? I don't know. It just breaks my heart, you know. It just absolutely breaks my heart because there is so much goodness out there, and I mean, we all seem to be so starving of goodness, and yet people would want us to cut us off from that. Interesting.
Well, it's fear, you know. It's trying to hold on to something, to some sense of personality and me, and they're the kind of, I think they're kind of worried that if we lose this fixed thing, I don't know what they're worried about. I watched a couple of those anti-yoga videos, and it was really difficult because they would kind of go back and forth going, well, yoga is good for stretching, and it's, of course, it's great to keep the body in shape, but, you know, it's actually a prayer to Satan.
Ta-da! But, you know, it's a curious kind of thing. Again, my perspective of, you know, religion, it has less to do with how, you know, one interacts with the divine in one's life, and it has so much more to do with control, you know, that the institution, the organization does not want to lose control over you. And if you somehow, you know, wander, you know, toward, you know, some other spiritual interest, you know, that might take control over you, and then we'd lose you. And
well, yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. It's really just the institution that's concerned, and that's what really comes down to.
Because Jesus didn't say anything about yoga that I know of.
No, he probably wasn't aware of yoga.
Exactly.
Well, I guess he was aware of everything.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. Hey, don't you get why I oughta.
Yeah.
So I'm just looking at my clock, and I see that our time is nearly up for today. And but I'm just getting to the really juicy parts of you. So can we invite you back for next week, and we can pick up where we left off?
Certainly.
Oh, how cool! So before we go, could you give us your website address and walk us around a bit and tell us where we can buy your books?
Well, the best place to get me on the web is hardcorezen.blogspot.com. You don't even need a www. It's just hardcorezen.blogspot.com. And that's my blog, and I try to update it every 2 or 3 days and, you know, keep it fresh. But there's links on there to anything else you'd want, like the books or some of the podcasts I've done and all this other stuff.
Yeah. And I hope to talk about your podcast a bit next week. So until next week, we will be visiting you in cyberspace.
Cool.
Thanks, kiddo. Be well.
You too.
Bye now. What a fantastic show, huh? Well, that's it for today, sex fans. I'm so glad you could join me. Tune in next week at this time for part two of my conversation with Brad Warner and more Sex Advice with an Edge with your host, me, Dr. Dick. Again, this week's podcast sponsor is Dr. Dick's How-To Video Library.
I'm trying to adopt a baby, but my job is making it impossible because my work self is suffocating my life me.
That does sound interesting. Listen up, buckaroos. Thanks to this amazing technology, you'll be able to watch your choice of smut from the comfort of your own home. With just a little prompting from you, they're going to come gushing out of your computer like nobody's business. Check it out. You'll find a link to this fabulous sex resource right there on the front page of DrDicksSexAdvice.com. Look for the banner in the sidebar that reads, Dr. Dick's How-To Video Library.
I eat emotionally, and one time in summer camp I kissed a girl on a dare, but then she drowned.
Oh, no. Listen, there's no membership fee to the How-To Video Library. This is a pay-per-minute sort of deal. So that means that your pay-per-view minutes allow you to watch whatever content you want for whatever length of time you choose. Pretty gall darn sweet, huh? One final thing. Would you like to become a podcast sponsor for one or more of my sex advice podcasts? As you know, I plug a product or service at the beginning and end of each show, just like I'm doing now. Each podcast has its own posting on my site, along with the name of the podcast sponsor and a banner for the product or service. The beautiful part of this unique opportunity is that once a sponsor's ad is included in a particular podcast, that sponsor is embedded there forever. Your sponsorship also underscores your social conscience. Your marketing dollars will not only go to promote your product, but you will also be doing so while helping to disseminate badly needed sex education and sexual enrichment messages. Simply put, you just can't get a better bang for your advertising buck. For further information, contact me through my site, drdicksexadvice.com. Until next week, remember, sex is good. And good sex? Why, that's even better. Over and out.